Good day, Gallatin Valley. Thank you for listening. I am Dr. Arliss Wood, psychologist, with co-host Dr. Suzanne Wood, speech-language pathologist. This is the Health and Happiness Show here on Community Radio, KGVM, 95.9 FM, and KGVM.org on the Internet. Another great program coming your way. And thank you to the Montana Psychological Association Public Education Committee for their support. Dr. Suzanne.
Good evening. From Columbia University, news coverage of the 2024 election season is often centered on how partisan division has affected our politics. But a new analysis shows that political polarization also poses significant health risks by obstructing the implementation of legislation and policies aimed at keeping Americans healthy, by discouraging individual action to address health needs, such as getting a flu shot, and by boosting the spread of misinformation that can reduce trust in health professionals. Over the past four decades, the paper's authors note partisan animosity has steadily increased. By 2020, Americans were much more likely to say they hate the opposite party than they were to say they love their own party. As individuals move further from the political center in either direction, there's a deterioration in individual and public health, such as trust in medical expertise, participation in healthy behaviors, and preventative practices, ranging from healthy diets to vaccination. Notably, individuals who are more ideologically extreme than their state's average voter have worse physical and mental health. Polarization affects what health information people are willing to believe and shapes the relevant actions they're willing to take. This may mean disregarding accurate information or believing misinformation, depending on whether or not it comes from sources they are aligned with or disagree with. Political leaders inside and outside the U.S. may make public health worse by linking health behavior to partisan identity rather than medical needs or expert advice, thereby undercutting the role of expertise and ignoring approaches grounded in science, often leading to attacks on medical professionals and the healthcare system. Interestingly, Republicans were less likely to enroll in marketplace insurance plans through the Affordable Care Act than were Democrats after most of its provisions began. These differences have been linked to, for those who did not join up, excess sick days from work, higher health care premiums, and higher mortality rates. According to the CDC, 400,000 more Republicans died of COVID-19 than Democrats. As polarization has increased, so has the difference in lifespan and health across states. Americans who live in states with more progressive social policies, such as generous Medicaid coverage, higher taxes on cigarettes, more economic support, in other words, a higher minimum wage, and more firearm regulations, live longer than their counterparts in states that embrace more conservative policies. After the Trump administration and other Republican leaders expressed skepticism regarding COVID-19 prevention behaviors, partisan elites and news sources amplified that, and polarized Republicans readily accepted. Large gaps then arose in vaccination rates and widened during the pandemic, even as evidence mounted about the risks. Again, we lost 400,000 good Republicans. These differences were not limited to the U.S. A previous study of 23 European countries found that national levels of partisan polarization accounted for nearly 39% in the variation in vaccination levels. And now today, even after all of this data has been processed and that we know it, politics are creating more changes and having more impact on our medical care as Americans. We have with us an aspiring medical professional, Brianna Merchant-Bulshaus, and Dr. Christina Myers, who are going to visit with us about their perspective on what's happening today on the medical scene and how we could navigate some of these changes. We're so happy to have you with us, Dr. Christina and Brianna. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
We realize that you work with this every day, and we're talking about it. We're trying to give some historic perspective on the changes that you've had to contend with. What do you see as some of the things that are happening right now, Dr. Myers?
I think it's striking, some of the information that you shared about sort of differences in how the polarization of information has changed the differences in mortality. It's pretty impressive in a sad way. I think thinking about immunizations in general, the change in recommendation for many immunizations to use shared decision-making with your provider rather than just recommending this vaccine that's been recommended for years for everyone to get without that questioning approach, really will highlight the lack of healthcare professionals that we have to serve our population. So many people looking for a new doctor have to wait 6, 8, 10, 12 weeks before they'll get that appointment. And so if you're going to wait on that appointment to have a conversation with your healthcare provider, as opposed to going to your county health department and just getting the vaccine because it's recommended to everybody, that's going to reduce overall vaccination rates because we don't have the capacity of primary care providers currently to have the opportunity to have those conversations with people. I would love to have those open conversations with people about which immunizations are right for them and why, but we don't have the healthcare professional population to provide that to all people.
I really appreciate you mentioning the health department for vaccinations. We have gone there for vaccinations. It's very efficient, very quick, very nice setting and nice people. So I really would follow up by saying that's a really good idea if you can't get in and you're running late on your vaccinations. I guess the other thing would be to schedule your appointment early so that you'll get there just on time and not lapse in any of your vaccinations or those of your children.
Absolutely.
And we see that there are also cuts in many medical programs right now, cuts in grants, cuts in funding for the poorer people. Have you seen much of that at Community Health Partners where you all are working, Christina?
We have. There were some extensions that were made during the COVID pandemic to prevent people from losing their Medicaid. So the re-enrollment process was changed as a part of the pandemic. And when that lapsed last year and people had to manually re-enroll in the program, many people lost their insurance. And they were still eligible for Medicaid, but maybe because they moved or missed their mail, they didn't receive the paperwork to re-enroll. And by going through that period where you don't have coverage, then you're probably not going to go to your follow-up appointment for managing your chronic disease. You may choose to not fill your prescription because you can't afford it without your insurance. And I think that's what we're anticipating we'll see now that the Affordable Care Act tax credits that also have been extended as a part of the COVID pandemic have lapsed, and people are seeing what their actual premiums are going to be without those tax credit subsidies. And unfortunately, people are choosing to make some pretty dramatic decisions and not have health insurance, again, then potentially foregoing preventive care and cancer screening and continuing their medication regimen because of cost.
Absolutely. That's such a frightening thought. And if they get really ill and they don't have medical insurance, how does that work, Dr. Myers?
Well, that can be a messy situation. I mean, someone who gets really ill can go to the emergency room, who is mandated to take care of everybody regardless of their ability to pay, and they may need to be hospitalized, which is an extremely expensive endeavor in the United States and elsewhere, and then you end up with a large amount of medical debt, which may be difficult to pay off for any person. And ultimately, those costs do get just sort of spread back out in the healthcare industry and impact the premiums that insured people are paying go up to cover the cost of that unreimbursed medical care.
Have you started seeing individuals who have had their insurance lapse yet, or is that still pending?
I think it's just going to be getting started. So that open enrollment period just ended. People had to either choose or not choose to pay their premium for January. And so I think we're just going to start seeing some differences there in the coverage that people have. I don't feel like we've quite seen it yet,
okay,
but it's coming.
Mm-hmm. Well, the CBO estimates that H.R. 1, this new bill for medical care, will increase the number of uninsured individuals by 7.5 million.
That's a big number.
Especially significant if you're one of those who's in that category.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Are you aware of how other countries with like Canada or Britain or some of the European countries, how they deal with healthcare?
I certainly don't know the like how those programs are funded, but my understanding is that every citizen has access to primary care and basic medical services at no cost to them. And then I think you can either buy additional insurance, or I don't really know the ins and outs of how that system funds itself, but the idea that everyone has access to primary care sounds like a pretty nice place to start.
It was interesting when we were in Australia several years ago with a group of college students. One of them injured his finger pretty badly. So we took him to a local clinic there in Australia. I think we were in Sydney at the time. You know, it was a beautiful clinic, just sparkling. And the doctor who came to help him got him all fixed up, got that finger set and what all they needed to do. It had been crushed when the tour bus luggage door fell down on his hand. And so we got ready to go and pay for that. And she said, oh, don't worry. It's pretty well covered here. No problem. And part of that tour, we also went to Japan. And in Japan, our daughter, who was with us, she was still in high school but got to come along. She had a fall on a mountain hike and broke her shoulder bone and had to go to a Japanese hospital. And I remember it was being something like 35 yen or something. And very good care, got the brace she needed. And we were just truly amazed how medical care was convenient. And our son-in-law's a doctor. We called him to make sure everything was done the way he would do it, and it was. So I don't know. That's just a little comment from personal experience.
Uh-huh. I know there's a great resistance to that. Things get labels like, oh, socialized medicine or some kind of threat to the capitalistic system or those kinds of things. I've never quite understood that. I think people are really satisfied in all the surveys that I've read about countries that have this kind of health system. They do sometimes complain about waiting lists, but I think everybody is covered. And anyway, we're not there. We're where we are. Some of the new policies, how are they affecting your giving care there at your clinic?
Well, fortunately, One Health, which was formerly called Community Health Partners, is a federally qualified health center. And so we do have programs in place to help people access health care, whether they have health insurance or not. And so for someone who is uninsured, they will never be denied care, and the cost of their care will be discounted based on their income. So it can be as low as zero cost for that office visit, or you know, full pay for someone who is outside of the income range. And then we also accept any form of insurance. And so similar to what I had mentioned before about the ER not turning anyone away, we also do not turn anyone away whether they have the ability to pay or not. So everybody has access to the same level of high-quality primary care.
I want to just state here, full disclosure, that we know personally of the good work because Dr. Myers is also our personal physician for, 7 years now. And we've had only the best of care in every instance. And we have not only a physician, but friends there. And I would like for you all to give your full name and your contact site and how to reach Community Health Partners for those listening who might need to have medical care but have difficulty figuring out how to obtain that.
So Community Health Partners merged with another federally qualified health center, and we're changing our name, which has been a slow process for all of us to learn and get used to. But we're called One Health now, and we are the West region of the One Health organization. And we have clinics in Bozeman, Livingston, and Belgrade. And all of our clinics offer both medical and behavioral health care. We have pharmacies in the Livingston and the Bozeman clinics. And we have dental offices in the Livingston and Bozeman clinics. And so we really try, as a mandate as a federally qualified health center, to take care of the whole person and the whole family. So mental health, physical health, dental health, are all covered.
And you see patients who have full insurance coverage and patients who have partial and patients who have no insurance. So that's one of the things we've always loved about this group.
Me too. That's what keeps me there.
So if this, the federally qualified health centers, if they were all over multiplied by 10, it would be maybe almost full coverage for the state. Would that be correct?
Yes.
And there, but the, how many of these are in Montana?
There are. So One Health has, I believe, 15 total clinics, three of which are in Wyoming, and the rest are in Montana. We have a service area the size of the state of Pennsylvania that we're covering, and we actually take care, I think it's as much as a third of the population of Montana. It's their health care through federally qualified health centers, which is higher than the national average.
That is impressive. Oh, I'm so proud of this group. Brianna, you're in with a very nice group.
I am so fortunate to have this opportunity to be with them. I'm so thankful.
Could we just ask you for a minute how you became interested in medicine and what your plans are? You know, whether you plan to specialize or go into general medicine. Give us a little update here, dear.
Yeah, so I actually always knew I wanted to be a doctor. I have always gone to my grandparents' and great-grandparents' chronic illness appointments with my mom. She's a nurse practitioner, but was a nurse at the time and was really the one who was the health advocate for my family, really helped them understand what their chronic illness was, the next steps, treatment options. And that's really where I want to come in with my community and be that person to help everybody understand what their health conditions is and, you know, understand their family health history and how that plays a role in, like, screening and things like that. So I want to come back to my reservation, which is the Crow Reservation in Pryor, Montana. And I'm thinking about becoming dual certified in both psychiatry and family medicine, because I know there's a big need for substance abuse programs on the reservation that are, like, tailored to the Crow people. And I kind of have a background with research with chronic illness management on my reservation and creating health programs that help the community manage their chronic illness better.
Wow, good going. And we applaud your efforts here. And tell us a little bit more about the reservation and what you see is some of the healthcare needs that you'll be addressing.
So currently on my reservation, in my community specifically, we do not have a medical doctor. A lot of our healthcare is actually run by nurse practitioners. And so while I was applying to medical school, I actually needed more shadowing hours from an MD. They have certain qualifications on that, which it became a barrier for me to actually apply to medical school because we don't even have access to that in my community. So I had to go out of my community to Billings to even be able to shadow. And so that's something I want to fill right there, is to be the medical doctor in the community. I also want to help other Native American students to become doctors too and help the shadowing hoops that we have to jump through with IHS because they are a governmental facility. But when it comes to issues in my community that I really want to address, it comes down to diabetes and substance abuse. So what I really want to do is come into my community and get those people that are in the pre-diabetic range and help them understand nutrition, how to read a food label, how to help them get out of that pre-diabetic range so they will not have that. And also when it comes to substance abuse, I really think it's so important for us as a community and us as a tribe to have a substance abuse program that is really rooted in my culture and our beliefs and our ways of living. And I think that's something that I really want to create for my people that's not there currently.
Yes, we've had tribal leaders on before telling us about the extremely high suicide rates upon the reservation, but also across Montana. We rank somewhere usually in the top three for suicide in Montana, and the reservations are even a little bit higher. So your emphasis on mental health and substance abuse is going to be very helpful, Brianna. That's excellent.
Yeah, thank you.
I was wondering, Dr. Myers, could you just tell us, in the ideal situation from a medical point of view, what vaccines should one be getting from birth all the way up? And also, what's happening now when there's a lot of question among, unfortunately, among a number of people about even getting a vaccine?
So the major changes that have been put in place by the current administration with the vaccine schedule, at this point, haven't really been embraced by the major medical communities. So the American Academy of Family Physicians, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the Academy of Internal Medicine are continuing with the standard schedule. And what I was mentioning before about, you know, consult with your doctor before receiving an immunization was the primary change that the administration made to a handful of vaccines, specifically related to hepatitis B, which traditionally is given at the time of birth and has really been shown to decrease the risks of liver cancer related to hepatitis B and death. So that is still recommended at the time of birth, and then it continues the series at your 2-month, 4-month, and 6-month infant visits, along with what goes in addition to that schedule at 2, 4, and 6 months. Babies should be receiving the rotavirus vaccine, diphtheria, tetanus, and acellular pertussis, Haemophilus influenza, pneumococcal, and the inactivated polio virus. When babies are 6 months or older, they can also receive the influenza vaccine and the COVID-19 vaccine. And I did miss their recommendation for the respiratory syncytial virus is actually to be given to mothers when they're pregnant with babies, so that, those antibodies get passed through the placenta to the baby and protect them. And then newborn babies also can get a single dose of the RSV vaccine as well. And then when you get to be one, you get some boosters of those other vaccines that you already received. And then you're also recommended to receive the varicella or chickenpox vaccine, measles, mumps, and rubella, and hepatitis A vaccines. And those, all of those are two-shot series that you get when you're one, and then again before you start kindergarten. And then over the lifespan, we get boosters of those vaccines at varying intervals, depending on both age, and then some chronic diseases alter that schedule a little bit based on risk. You know, if you're immune suppressed or have other health issues, your vaccine schedule would be just slightly different.
Thank you for that. And there have been political figures who've stated categorically that there's a good chance that vaccinations cause autism. Could you address that for us, please?
Yes, that is a really unfortunate piece of misinformation that was popularized in the lay press and has been refuted over and over again as not being reliable science to support that. It was initially reported related to the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine as thought to be a cause, but there is no evidence to support that. It's unfortunate, sort of a link in timing developmentally in children with autism at that age when you would receive that vaccine. So, you know, around
between 1 and 2 years of age is where children with autism can really start to show some developmental differences that would allow for that diagnosis to happen. And so that causal link got kind of misrepresented in the data. And there has been some concern about increasing rates of autism across the German population. And I think that that's really multifactorial, both in our increased awareness of autism as a spectrum and identifying people both who have very severe autism and also who maybe have less overt traits and symptoms of autism. And so part of that is increasing the incidence that we're seeing. And then there are many other factors that influence just the prevalence of neurodiversity disorders, or I guess diagnoses is a better word, that we're just learning more about and learning how to recognize and identify that changes the incidence as well. But there has not been any reliable research to show a causal effect from any vaccine.
And there are numerous large studies with thousands of people reviewed that have validated your statements there. Thank you.
I noticed there was a spike in measles. I think it's in West Texas. Where is that? Is that spreading or has it been contained?
I am worried that we're nearing the point where measles is going to become endemic again in the United States. There are not currently any cases that are being monitored in Gallatin County, but there have been several small outbreaks that we've seen. And if we go a full year where there are outbreaks across the country, then it will be changed from, you know, we used to have measles as an eradicated vaccine-preventable illness. And if we go a full year with recurrent cases, it's going to become endemic again, which is really unfortunate.
And that is, again, we'll reference those comments earlier about why politics should not be what guide us in our medical care, because it's dangerous.
It really is. That loss of scientific integrity in the information that gets shared out in the world. I think this has been a real challenge just with the tremendous growth in the internet. People have access to so much information. It can be hard to tease through what is high quality information and what isn't. I try and remind people of this regularly as they're looking up information. If any website comes with a .com, that website is trying to sell you something. It is a commercial website. It's trying to make money. Whereas educational websites, so information that comes from universities, it's going to be a .edu. Informational websites, .org, an organization, they are not trying to make money off of you. They are just trying to share information, and so those would be much more reliable sources. But now we're inundated with this world of influencers and people who have maybe no scientific education at all, just sharing information. And so it's hard to tease through what's real and what is opinion, what is science, and what is someone's belief system. And so it can be very overwhelming to try and identify information. So I think maintaining a trusting relationship with a health professional that we can have reliable information and good conversation and actually educate people, like Brianna was saying, to prevent chronic disease and improve the health and well-being of everyone is, you know, why we're in this profession at all.
Well, this is also this political intrusion into the medical sector has had a lot of impact across the globe. We hear from the Global Societal Network for Physicians, October 2025, that many doctors stress that political agendas often overshadow medical evidence, warning peers to advocate for science-based policy and push back against regulations that compromise patient care. With 62% of physicians saying politics should not influence medical decisions, these voices lead the healthcare debates, but sadly, a staggering 44% of members in the Global Network for Physicians, 44% report they have seen physicians leave their practices due to politics.
That is a huge number.
And we want.
We already have such tremendous shortages in healthcare professionals.
Yeah, and we're so grateful, Brianna, and proud that you're entering this field. And we need you desperately, and you're a model also for other young tribal members and young people or interested people everywhere. You're a model for going into the thought of becoming a doctor. And by the way, it's not just for young people. We had a friend who was a major in the military, and he retired after the usual 25 years or however many years it is. And guess what he did? He went to medical school. He said, I'll have another 15 or 20 years to practice. And they happily admitted him to medical school, which is no small thing. And so I just wanted to point out that anybody of any age could actually consider going into the medical sector. And there are other ways besides being a physician.
I had another question about disease. What about the flu? How is it in Gallatin County and nationwide?
It has been a big year for influenza this year. We've seen lots of hospitalizations and, unfortunately, a pretty high mortality rate. I know I was just looking before this session started, and the last couple weeks in Gallatin County, there has not been as much of an increase in influenza cases, so we're doing pretty good right now. But overall, there have been over 1,000 positive cases, and, or I'm sorry, 2025 year-to-date, 4,000 positive cases in the state of Montana, and 250 hospitalizations or deaths related to influenza. Chances are in the next week or so we might see another increase again just because of holiday travel and exposure, and people are going to start showing up with their new flu cases, unfortunately. But it's been a big year for influenza.
Where is COVID now?
At the current report that I'm looking at for Gallatin County, COVID is, the influenza line is flat for the last couple weeks, and COVID's on an upward trend. In 2025, there were 8,900 positive COVID cases. They don't have hospitalizations or deaths on this report that I'm looking at.
Is that in Montana or?
It just, yes, in Montana.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
What about polio? I've heard some dire predictions on that.
I think there is some real concern, similar to measles coming back, that we're going to start seeing polio again. Again, this was eradicated from the United States, but still exists across the globe. And because we have opportunities for international travel, people can pick up polio, and if they are not immunized, then potentially cause illness here again in the United States. I know that we've talked about this on previous shows, but the two of you remember when the polio vaccine became available and what a tremendous impact that had after, you know, all those public spaces had been shut down due to polio outbreaks, you get to go back out and kind of start living your life again.
Yes, incredibly, a few years back here in Bozeman, I was at an exercise class at the Y here, and a young mother was so happily saying that they're not getting that polio vaccine. And she said, it's just like a bad flu, and it also could cause autism. Well, I had to take a minute and breathe, because I remember iron lungs, where people were so sick that they couldn't breathe on their own. I remember death after death after death, and especially children dying. And I remember as a little girl, maybe 4 or 5 years old, that there were so many things we couldn't do. They had to close the movies. They had to close the swimming pools. We were just at home trying to avoid getting sick when it got so bad. And the people who did get sick, I have a close speech therapy friend, for instance, who had polio and had an extreme limp, which as she got older turned into a wheelchair due to her childhood polio experience. And she was one of the fortunate ones. So I just wanted to let people know it's a horrible, horrible disease. And we all lined up. There were long lines of people and got that vaccination. And within a month, we were all back to our lives. And it's so sad to think that any child in this day and age would be subjected to not having that inoculation.
And I do think you made a really important point, is that, you know, this immunization worked. We eradicated polio from the United States. And now people don't remember what it was like. They didn't have to experience it, and they don't have that lived history, maybe passed down from their own grandparents about their experience, because we don't have communities like that that, you know, share that history and that lived experience. And so when you're inundated with information that tells you this immunization is more dangerous than it is beneficial, of course, every parent wants to do the best thing for their child and keep their child healthy. And so it's that lack of memory of how severe polio was and how many people were dying, and then these long-term sequelae of the disease, that we just don't have that knowledge base anymore and that memory to help guide our decision-making and see that, yes, this vaccine really works, and we don't have this terrible disease anymore. So, of course, we want to keep immunizing our patients. But instead, there's all this misinformation that feeds in without that historical context of memory.
And it should be a great credit to the vaccine that people don't even know anymore. It's so taken care of, that problem. People are completely ignorant. At that time, I remember even the president of the United States had polio and was very ill, and was later in a wheelchair and crippled because of polio. So, yeah, we need to remind people there's a reason. It just breaks my heart to think any child would be put at risk this way.
Yeah.
I know that there was...
Yeah.
Used to be, and may, you could enlighten us on this, requirements to go to school, daycare, different places that you had to have certain immunizations. And I know from a certain group there's a pushback on that and said they either had a religious exemption or so forth. Where does that stand? Do you know?
So the public school system follows the minimum guideline requirements for the immunization, so that schedule that I was going through before. Private schools have always had, you know, different rules, but public-funded schools need to follow those minimum requirements. And then the religious exemption, I believe state to state has some variance as to like what the requirements are to get out of that. In Montana, it really is self-report. And so if you say that based on your religion, you cannot get these vaccines, as far as I know, that's all it really takes in Montana. So that's really unfortunate that it makes it quite easy to not follow the standard schedule, because that immunizations work both because each individual person who received it is protected, and then if at least 80% of that population where that individual person lives is also immunized, then you develop what's called herd immunity, and it's much less likely that you're going to have an outbreak of any given disease when that high percentage of people are all immunized. So we get some sort of community protection when everybody is vaccinated. And as the number of unvaccinated people increases, then you lose that community protection, that herd immunity, because there aren't enough people to kind of keep the whole group protected. And so then that makes everybody more vulnerable.
And I wonder if you could help correct me if I have this wrong, but I understand that babies can't have certain inoculations till they get a bit older. So those babies who are waiting and too young yet to get full inoculation are some that would be very much at risk by being around others who are not vaccinated.
Yes, and that is something that's really been brought into concern again. So the current schedule that we follow is based on scientific research about the immune system and when our immune system can respond to certain vaccines, and the interval at which you get those boosters is all based on very rigorous scientific study. It wasn't just an arbitrary creation of any sort of schedule. And there have been modifications over time. So it used to be that as a young child, you would get diphtheria, tetanus, and acellular pertussis all together in this series over your childhood. But then after the age of 18, all you needed to do was continue your tetanus booster every 10 years. But that recommendation has changed as we're seeing an increase in pertussis or whooping cough come back. Now the recommendation is every 10 years you get the booster of the combined vaccine. You continue to get the tetanus, but also the acellular pertussis, so a Tdap, because we found over time that that immunity to the acellular pertussis doesn't last as long as we thought it did. And so pertussis has come back. And so to try and combat that again, to get that pertussis booster every 10 years with your tetanus booster is going to hopefully knock those pertussis outbreaks down again. But we have seen in Gallatin County the last two winters there have been pertussis outbreaks. And that's, the whooping cough is the 100-day cough. It is not an illness that anyone wants. And for the very young, infants, and very old, it can be deadly because of all of the secretions that are produced. Can really be deadly for your airway and cause a really high mortality rate.
I know that oftentimes those who fight against vaccines and other kinds of standardized care use the word individual freedom, that somehow trumps the, I hate to use that word, that it causes, is it quite different from group freedom, that we emphasize individual freedom over the welfare of the group sometimes. And I told at least one person who said that they had the right not to get a vaccine. I said, well, the thing is, I feel like I have the right not to be exposed to you if you're going to get me sick and possibly cause serious illness or death. So it's interesting how freedom is used and misused.
Right. I agree with that. But that idea that I was talking about before of herd immunity, you know, if you don't have high percentage of people that are receiving that vaccine, then the whole group increases their potential risk for exposure. But that individual who's choosing not to vaccinate themselves, you know, they don't live on a bubble. They don't live on their own island. They live in a community.
And so their children live in a community. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
The rest of the community.
I wonder, Brianna, are you familiar with the vaccination rates with your tribal group? How are they doing on vaccinations?
I know that when the COVID vaccine first happened, I really helped to make an effort to educate everybody on the vaccine. Because like we're talking about, there was a lot of misconceptions and things like that and misinformation spewed out. But I work with this nonprofit organization, so we put together a pamphlet that we handed out to the community, and it showed my grandma actually getting the vaccine, and we just put some facts on there and really made it digestible for people to take in and really understand. I don't really know the specific facts on my community, but I do know, like, I'm also Blackfeet too, and I'm proud to say that when COVID first happened, they were like 95 to 98% vaccinated in their population in 2021.
Yay, wow.
So their vaccine
was
so high. They also did a lot of regulations and stuff like that that seemed very, they were just like very strict during that time. Like nobody could be out. They had a strict curfew. And they also did a lot of education, too. Like, people, when they went into the stores, they had to wear gloves or masks. If not, they were kicked out. They were very strict on adhering to the CDC policies. And I think that's what really helped them to not lose as many people and also to get as many people vaccinated. Because they also educated people that you're taking the vaccine not only for yourself, but for your community. Because in a lot of our communities, we have, like, 10 people living in one home. So you have these small kids that are coming in and bringing in COVID to their grandparents. And, you know, in my community, that's how a lot of people were passing away on the Crow Reservation. So being able to educate the community and how they can save our elders was so big. And I think that's what really picked up specifically with the Blackfeet, because they were protecting their elders and protecting the small kids.
I applaud your beautiful golden education help for those people, so they would know exactly why and why it was so serious. Good work, Brianna and your team.
Thank you.
Is there anything that the public should know now that perhaps they don't have ready access to, or we haven't heard about any burgeoning disease coming up here?
Say no.
Oh, that's terrifying.
Well, we all remember when COVID started, and we had children and grandchildren in New York City where they didn't have enough room in the morgues. And so we need to be grateful to the scientists who created the vaccines that ended that horrible onslaught of disease and freed us all from our homes again and freed us all from wearing a mask day and night. Occasionally now we should all still wear them, but it's like the medical science is like diamonds and jewels and golden auras around us, and we need to applaud their work and respect their work and listen to their work. And we thank you as medical professionals for highlighting this and dedicating your lives. We need you.
Thank you.
One area that people, again, don't talk about much, and I don't know where it is in the contagion, but like STIs, STDs, is there anything that's developing, like strains that are resistant the treatment?
Recommendations are changing frequently around the management of chlamydia and gonorrhea, which unfortunately are sort of continuing to be pervasive in communities.
We did see over the last year a really dramatic increase in the prevalence of syphilis in Montana and across the country. And so we have increased the frequency of screening for syphilis amongst a more broad population than we used to do previously. Fortunately, syphilis is still very treatable just with penicillin, which is widely available, but it's a sneaky little disease, and so you have to really look for it so that you can treat people appropriately. But that has been a change that I've seen just in the last year, is that we're really screening for it more often in a broader population as opposed to just a higher risk population of, say, sex workers or men who have sex with men, just sort of screening everybody to really identify it and be able to treat it effectively. But antibiotic resistance around chlamydia and gonorrhea is an ongoing problem, and so those recommendations change as far as what the preferred treatment course is for that. But those would be the most common sexually transmitted infections that we kind of look at and manage on a regular basis.
I wonder, we're getting toward the end here, if you could tell us again where you're located, how people could come to visit you all, remind them of your services, and we should also throw out the news to anyone looking for an internship. I believe you also train interns quite a bit, don't you, Dr. Myers?
We do. So we, for behavioral health professionals, people who are getting licensed to be counselors, they can do their internship hours with our in our different locations to continue on their path. But our locations in Bozeman, we are at 1695 Shockey Lane behind Lowe's on 19th Avenue. And like I said previously, our Bozeman clinic offers medical care, behavioral health care, dental care, and has a pharmacy. And then our site that is in Livingston is at 112 West Lewis Street. Our Livingston clinic also has medical care, behavioral health care, dental, and pharmacy on site. The Livingston clinic also hosts the Parents as Teachers program and does a lot of adult education for Park County in their clinic space as well. And then our Belgrade clinic is right on Main Street and just currently has medical care and behavioral health care. And then, unfortunately, folks have to come into Bozeman to access the other services, but really doing our best to treat the whole community. And again, we're welcoming everyone, regardless of your income, your insurance status, your ability to pay. We want to keep our communities healthy and take care of everyone.
Oh, thank you so much. And quickly tell me, would they look up, say, for a phone number, One Health now, or Community Health Partners still?
Yes. If you look up Community Health Partners, because that's a more familiar name and we have not updated our signs yet, you will be directed to One Health off the website.
Thank you so much, Dr. Myers. And Brianna, thank you. This has been very enlightening. I'd like to tell the people in Gallatin County, you can listen to this program Monday evenings at 7 or Thursday mornings at 9. And we thank these health professionals for enlightening us and helping us stay healthy and happy. We'll see you later.